the talk of planet Earth.
Are you ready?
This is TalkZone.com, Internet Talk Radio.
New message.
It's showtime.
TalkZone.com.
Now, the Dave Baum Show on TalkZone.com, Internet Talk Radio. Here's your host, Dave Baum.
Welcome. Nice to have you back again with us on the Dave Baum Show right here on TalkZone.com, Internet Talk Radio at its best, contemporary and current. And by the way, thanks to all of you who have helped this show grow since we first started a few months back. I am told we are now heard in over 95 countries and 4,100 cities. So thank you for making TalkZone.com your spot, and also the Dave Baum Show for finding out what's going on with great guests, with great insight. Important administratively or logistically to tell you that our phone number is toll-free if you'd like to join us as a caller. 1-888-463-6748. That's 1-888-463-6748. That's a toll-free number. If you're overseas listening to this show, our number is 011. You'll need a pencil for this. 011. A lot of numbers to remember. 847-470-0937. That's 011-847-470-0937 if you're calling from overseas and want to get in. Conversations today about a couple of interesting, current, and extremely relevant issues. One has to do with race, the other has to do with divorce. And we invite you to join us as a listener or caller. When it comes to talking black and white, my friends, I guess I've seen a whole lot in my X number of years on this earth. I joined the NAACP in Illinois in the 60s when I got out of the Army. Thought the idea of black couples and white couples having dinner together and exchanging goals and aspirations worked. I certainly remember them with fondness. That open conversation about race didn't last very long. White and black big mouths got in the way. Tried to re-up in the NAACP when I moved to Chicago. Was told, thanks but no thanks, but we will take your money. Met and reported on black civil rights leaders who encouraged quiet talk between the colors. People like Martin Luther King, who was in Chicago for a brief period of time, Ralph Abernathy, local people who many of you probably wouldn't remember or know the names of, Al Raby, James Compton, Ralph Metcalf, an Olympic great in his own right who became a political leader in Chicago. Reported on others during my years as a on-the-street reporter, like Elijah Muhammad, Jesse Jackson, Louis Farrakhan, who disdained anything remotely like unity of color. As a result, I've become a dropout to chatter about blacks and whites talking at and not to each other because it doesn't happen. Everybody's talking, but nobody's listening. And along comes Barack Obama, who says he wants to begin a fresh discussion about a colorblind America. Of course, the man who would be president sat for more than 20 years in a Southside Chicago church and listened to a man of God excoriate white America for untold sins of omission and commission. Is America ready for a new racial dialogue? Is Obama in a clever way playing a different kind of race card to attract independents and centrist left Republicans who can't stand the religious right? Is race a liability or advantage to Obama? One thing's for sure. Obama's got a lot of people talking about black and white issues from the pulpit to the dinner table. Dr. Shelby Steele is a research fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. He's the Robert J. and Marion E. Oster Senior Fellow at Hoover. His opinion column in the Wall Street Journal, The Obama Bargain, after the candidate's Philadelphia speech, raised new issues and questions about the Illinois senator. Dr. Steele, welcome. Nice to have you with us on the Dave Baum Show.
Good to be here.
Some think the Obama speech is a breakthrough in color conversations. Others see it as a fancy litany, nothing new. How about you?
Well, I'm probably in the latter camp. He had scrupulously tried to keep race out of his campaign up until the Reverend Wright controversy broke out, and then all of a sudden he wants us to have a national dialogue on race. So I'm a little cynical about his motives here.
Is it reasonable to believe that reasonable people, whites and blacks, can have a reasonable discussion at a much higher level than it's been before, in or out of the public purview?
Well, you know, in many ways, one of the things that interests me about America today is that really both races have a pretty good understanding of what our racial history has been, what the conflicts have been, what we've argued over everything from welfare to affirmative action, and all sorts of Supreme Court decisions. So I think we have a pretty good idea of what race is, and so I'm not one that feels we need to have a big self-conscious dialogue on race. What would that constitute? President Clinton tried to do that, and it just sort of became a silly kind of venture. They went around from city to city and interviewed people and had people come in and testify, and it went absolutely nowhere. Probably Obama already regrets having asked for one, because it sort of ties him back into race, which is where he clearly does not want to be as a candidate.
Dr. Steele, I agree with you, because at least from my perspective, and you heard, you know, what I said really at the opening of the show, about my own background as a white guy in all of this racial conversation, plus or minus, it seems to me that the race card, as it's called, has absolutely no value, but still gets played over and over again for political advantage. And if the purpose of politics is to win, any candidate in his or her right mind is going to use it whenever feasible, wouldn't you say?
I think so. I think so. To the extent that it's effective. One of the problems with the race card at this point is that it's so transparent. When Clinton used it in South Carolina, everybody just saw immediately through that. I'm sure they're absolutely going to use it in the political campaign if they have the slightest feeling that it might be effective. And it might still have some effectiveness, I'm not sure, but it's certainly not an overwhelmingly powerful tool anymore.
One of the things I found very interesting and insightful to me about your column in the Wall Street Journal was the division that you made between the bargainers, as you define them, and the challengers. Would you, for our audience on TalkZone.com, define bargainers, who they are, what they seem to stand for, and challengers, who they are and what they seem to stand for?
Sure. These are masks that blacks can wear when they enter the American mainstream. Bargainers are people who always say to white, who give whites the benefit of the doubt, who always say, I'm going to presume that you are not a racist, and I'm going to make that presumption on the bargain that you not hold my race against me. And so bargainers are, whites are very happy to make that bargain, because they don't want America's history of racism to be rubbed in their face constantly. Mm-hmm. And so they're very grateful to bargainers, and bargainers invariably become very, very popular people who are objects of affection. Oprah Winfrey is a good example of a bargainer. Bill Cosby back in the 80s, Sidney Poitier, where people who are generally well loved by the public. Challengers are the exact opposite. They say, I'm never going to give you the benefit of the doubt. I'm going to presume you are a racist until you do something, give me some form of racial preference or other. And if you do that, then and only then will I give you absolution and say you're not a racist. So Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson have been good examples of people who functioned as challengers over the years.
So what seems to be missing here, at least from the description, Dr. Steele, is something in the middle, somewhere between a bargainer and a challenger promoting a new type of conversation, if there's going to be one in this country. Let me use the term modifier. Do you see anybody on the scene? And again, I'm not trying to grab any of your glory, because I thought your column was sensational in the way you placed it and just defined it. But somewhere between a bargainer and a challenger in the black community, do you see a modifier who can combine the best of both worlds without stridency?
I do. I think the thing that both bargaining and challenging are masked. They're not, in other words, they're ways that blacks present themselves, and there's an element of deception in both of them. What I'm arguing for and hope for in the future is that blacks can enter the American mainstream without wearing any mask at all, without manipulating whites in any particular way, entering the mainstream as strictly as individuals. And I think there are some blacks who I see today in the political world who have begun to do that. I think Harold Ford in Tennessee is somebody who, running for high office as Harold Ford. And these are his convictions, and this is what he stands for and he believes in. You can take it or you can leave it, but that's who he is as an individual. There's no manipulation there of white sentiment one way or the other. Michael Steele, no relation. To me, in Maryland, is another one. Ken Blackwell in Ohio is another one. Lynn Swan in Pennsylvania. I think all of these represent a generation of blacks who are simply coming to the American mainstream as themselves. And in that sense, then they're on both sides of the political spectrum, but they're a breath of fresh air.
Our guest on the Dave Baum Show is Dr. Shelby Steele from the Hoover Institution, the Robert J. and Marion E. Oster Senior Fellow. Dr. Steele, I want to play a portion of an interview that Barack Obama has done very recently when he was in Philadelphia for the speech. He did this on a sports talk show, and basically the background on it is sports talk, and then the issue was kind of easy because Obama is a sports fan. He likes to participate in basketball and other sports. He's kind of a jock among a myriad of candidates today who are running for offices of that nature who aren't jockish at all. So Obama's a jock. He's on a sports talk show. He's talking to co-hosts. They talk about sports. And then one of the hosts asks him this question, and I'll be interested in your reaction to his response.
You gave an amazing speech on Tuesday, and you talked about your white grandmother and how there was a time when even she feared black men, and that she even occasionally would use a racial or ethnic stereotype. Right. What does she say now about you being so close to the presidency?
Well, you know, she is extremely proud. And the point I was making was not that my grandmother harbors any racial animosity. She doesn't. Right. But she is a typical white person who, you know, if she sees somebody on the street that she doesn't know, you know, there's a reaction that's been bred into our experiences that don't go away, and that sometimes come out in the wrong way. And that's just the nature of race in our society. We have to break through it. And what makes me optimistic is you see each generation feeling a little bit less like that.
Dr. Steele, in your opinion, how deep do you think the so-called racial phobia is in this country today?
Well, you know, it's one thing that's interesting to me is that if I was walking down, Jesse Jackson has said that if he were walking down the street at night and he saw a group of black teenagers walking behind him, he would cross the street. He would have anxiety. I think any sane person would. The other side of this is that blacks commit 9 times more cross-racial crime than any other group in society. 55% of all federal prisoners are black, even though we're only 11% of the population. So there is a well-founded anxiety in this area that blacks share as just as much as whites or any other group If you are a black and you're passed by, a cab driver passes you by in New York City, that cab driver is likely to be black. And so this is another side of the conversation that rarely gets stated because of political correctness. We're just supposed to presume that the white person is being racist. And I don't think that's necessarily true. I think it's, you know, there's a rational foundation to this anxiety. That said, obviously we don't want to deal in stereotypes, but when you have a disproportionate amount of crime being committed by one group, then of course you're going to have people who, and it's not to his grandmother's discredit that she feels this way. She's just a sane person.
When somebody from your perspective is concerned about being painted as a racist or somebody else who has negative vibes about somebody else who has a different culture or is a different color, it would seem to me that over the years what that's done is it's basically eliminated any opportunity for dialogue. And I'm not talking about the public dialogue, the Jacksons, the Sharptons, the Obamas. I'm talking about the type of dialogue that I referred to about 45 years ago in a small town in Illinois, where it was the feeling then of people that if you got people together with like interests, happiness for your family, success, good education for kids, kids wind up doing better than you do. If you do that at a quiet level, you can succeed. I don't see much of that anymore, do you?
No, there's, you know, we've fallen into an age of identity politics where, you know, we started, the big mistake we made, I think, coming out of the 60s, was to start rewarding people for their ethnicity and their race and their gender. So we put, power on the table. And when that happens, then the incentive is for us to all pull back into our groups and sort of fight and argue with each other over power, make demands on the society. It was a profound mistake, and we're still sort of stuck there to some degree. And I grew up in Chicago in the era that you're talking about. I knew Al Raby, so we have a similarity there. And things were absolutely more open in those days, and there was more of a willingness to sit down and communicate.
Why has that changed? Because it's just absolutely astounding to me that as people have gotten brighter, more educated, hopefully learned a little bit more about each other, culture, etc., you would think by definition that people would be closer to the type of meaningful dialogue that neither you nor I see right now.
That's right. It's painful. I talk to younger people, blacks from a younger generation than mine, who like to brag in a sense and say that they've changed and they're much more advanced. But when I see them, we were much more advanced in my day in the 50s and the 60s before we fell into this identity politics, this idea of, for blacks, it was, you know, you had this narrow definition of what it means to be black. If you're not a challenger, you're not black. If you're not protesting, you're not black. And that's a kind of, you know, it binds you and cuts you off from other people, and so that your advantage is just sticking together with your own group rather than opening yourself as a human being to other people. What we've lost is this idea of human commonality, which was, I think, in the original civil rights movement, as led by Dr. King, was the focus. The focus was not on, there was no such word as blackness. Dr. King would talked about, I'm a man, we're human beings, we have a commonality that is vastly more important than our racial differences, and we ought to focus on that. That's what we've lost, and that's the tragedy.
When Barack Obama talks about change, since you have the advantage of looking back at all aspects of the latter part of the 20th century into the 21st, what do you think he means when he talks about change? I'm having a difficult time putting a face on change.
Well, I'm with you there. I have not the slightest idea. It's one of my real charges against Obama is that you get this sort of glowing rhetoric that is just stunning for its almost absolute emptiness. I mean, there's no vision of what change might be, no concrete idea based on history, based on some understanding of where we are now and where he would like to see us go. So it is hope and all of his rhetoric is just blank. We don't have a clue. My sense is that Obama himself does not know what he means by it.
From a political standpoint, expedient standpoint, can he afford to put a face on change either before he gets the nomination, if he does, and if he does against McCain? Can he afford to put a face on change?
Well, I think he should. I think it probably will be his only chance. In the book that I just wrote about him, A Bound Man, my whole point in that book is that Obama has nurtured this invisibility where he doesn't tell us what he means by any of his rhetoric, and that at some point, if you want to be the president of the United States, you're going to have to let Americans know who you really are and what you really mean by change. Change from what to what? And if he doesn't do that, if he fails to do that, then, I mean, that's going to make him, it seems to me, vulnerable to somebody like McCain, who is the opposite, who is very clear, whether one agrees with him or whether one doesn't. Mm-hmm. He's a concrete politician who's very much in reality, very much down on the ground. And it's going to be hard for Obama to keep this sort of vague sensationalism going without coming up with some concrete visions for what he wants.
Dr. Steele, because of the last 8 years of what I call this desperate Republican administration of George Bush and the last 4 years of Bill Clinton, have those 12 years come together to make Barack Obama a very viable candidate? In other words, if history hadn't come down to this point where we've had basically a miserable 8 years and a four previous to that that was loaded with controversy morally and ethically about the guy who was in the White House, would Obama even be, in your opinion, a viable candidate at this time?
Probably not. I shouldn't speak too quickly. He might well be. Again, he is a bargainer, and there is in American society, and I think that the Obama phenomenon is much more about white America than it is about Barack Obama. There is a hunger, almost a desperation in white America to get past this racial conflict that we've had now for several centuries, to redeem America, to vote to put a black man in the White House so that we can then finally say we are not a racist society, and this is proof of who we are. That's an engine in American life that we don't remark on very much. But that's what I think is pulling Barack Obama forward, probably more than anything else.
Well, if it's as powerful as you say it is, and I'm not going to doubt it, then in reality, there's no reason to put a face on change.
That's the way he's been playing it so far. That's the thing is that.
Boy, you know something? Can you see a room full of his acolytes sitting around and dreaming up the kind of philosophy? The political philosophy we're talking about now, does that happen?
I don't think so.
Wow.
No, I don't think so. I think they know they're riding a wave of some kind. And to be more specific and begin to define things, in other words, to become visible as a complicated human being, he loses charm. He loses charisma. His mystery kind of disappears. He becomes, again, more of an individual, less of a symbol, an icon. And so he doesn't want to define anything if he doesn't have to. He avoids it in every way he can.
Having a black father and a white mother, is this beneficial to him at this time?
what it does is it helps him as a bargainer, because whites look at that and they say, well, okay, his mother was white, his grandmother was white, his grandfather, he was raised by whites, so he is going to give us the benefit of the doubt. He's not going to presume that all whites are racist. He knows better than that, and so he's going to be more open to us. And so that, I think, helps, gives him an appeal that other blacks might not have.
We know how Clinton would lead. We've seen examples of that when she was the first lady, and we've seen examples of it in the primary. A fairly dogmatic woman, has a lot of positive political astuteness. How would you think Obama would lead?
Well, there again, the campaign has been so vague, and we know so little about him, and he's had so little actual experience leading that it's almost impossible to say. It is, you know, I hate to say that President Clinton's remark about the rolling the dice. I think there's some truth in that. I couldn't say how he would lead. I think he would try to be ecumenical. I think he would try to talk to both sides in some ways, but that's much more difficult. That's easier said than done.
Mm-hmm.
So how he would actually do that and play inside hardball politics, I don't know.
It seems to be, Dr. Steele, a fascinating time. You and I come from basically the same generation. We're aware of the same kind of people, saw things happen in the 60s that hadn't happened before. Here we are almost 50 years later. We're talking about a candidate that you define as a bargainer for the way you see him. Yet in talking to my kids, who are a heck of a lot younger, and I think probably are educationally a heck of a lot smarter than I am, but maybe don't have as much street smarts, what I notice is that when I say to them, do you kids see any relationship between the JFK days of the late 50s, early to mid, early 60s, and this, since they only have a textbook to refer to, they don't see what I see, which is kind of like you mentioned it a little bit earlier. There's a fervor out there among young people that I saw back prior to the Nixon-Kennedy election and then Kennedy's few years in office that I kind of sense now, but I don't see any other... I don't see anything that's the same. Do you?
You mean beyond that? No, I don't.
Yeah.
I think the analogies to Kennedy are probably... don't hold up. I remember him as a candidate, a more substantial person, someone who you did have a better idea, you knew better, you knew, or at least you knew more about him than you do Barack Obama. We're finding out things every day. I mean, the trouble he's gotten into with his pastor, his response to that is sort of immediately asking for a national dialogue on debate on race. Is he going to do that? You know, every time he gets in trouble as a president, he's just a very he's done a very good job of nurturing this invisibility, of not giving us a clear enough idea about who he is.
Could Pastor Wright turn out to be the Achilles heel of Barack Obama?
It's certainly going to stay there. If he gets the nomination, which it looks like he will, the Republicans certainly will use it. They will ask for more explanation. How did you sit there for 20 years, subject your daughters to this kind of hate talk? It is a stunning.
Well, can't it happen? You're a Chicago guy. Can't it happen if you're living on the South Side in Hyde Park, which is kind of an oasis anyway? For people who don't know anything about Chicago, it's an oasis. It's an intellectual and educational oasis. Can't that happen if you're living in Hyde Park and you're going to a church with people like yourself, same social status, friends and neighbors, and hear things from a minister that from time to time you kind of roll your eyes? That happens to a lot of people, doesn't it?
Well, you know, here's a man who is telling the United States of America that he wants to run because he wants to transcend race. Who he wants a post-racial world for us all. who for 20 years has sat there listening Sunday after Sunday to an absolute bigot, a black nationalist, a fanatic, somebody who hates America, who is endlessly critical of America, endlessly consumed with race, consumed with blackness. Well, that doesn't look like transcendence to me. And so, you know, I grew up there. I know this minister. I know other churches like that. I come from the same background that Barack Obama comes from. My mother was white as well. If I went to that church, I'd sit there one Sunday, hear that, and say, is my mother welcome here? Is Obama's mother welcome here? Then it's not the kind of church I would believe in. If your own mother is not going to be welcome there, then what in God's name are you doing there? It's just one of those stunning contradictions in character that make you fearful about who this man really is.
Dr. Shelby Steele, thank you very much for joining us on the Dave Baum Show. I appreciate your insight, and hopefully we can talk again.
I'd love to. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Dr. Shelby Steele, our first guest in this hour on elevating the issue of race to a higher degree of conversation, public or not. We'll continue our conversation on the Dave Baum Show. Invite you to be a caller at 1-888-463-6748. Stick around.